first relating to your over 248, the last sentence, as presently drafted, appears the PDP is more focused on protection than the land. The second last sentence, actually. Given that we've been advised by staff that O&L's ONS make up 96.97% of the district, it would seem to be a very high percentage probability that any mining will be either in an O&L or an ONF. So the proposition I want to put to you, the opportunity to tell me why I'm wrong, is isn't that what Section 6B tells us exactly what we should be doing, namely protecting those features of landscapes?
Yes, I think that is one element of Section 6B and an important element, but it is also qualified by with respect to inappropriateness as well from use development protection or from the effects of subdivision and use. So I don't think it's about protection outright, and that sentence is also a remark in the context of the preceding section, or the preceding sentence, which is about the whole of Section 5 and it providing for an enabling approach to the management of resources.
Well, on the basis of the days late, I've already talked to you about Kings Avenue, we won't go there. Looking at the operative RPS in Section 6.3, as I read that objective, 5.4.5, as coloured by the explanation and the policy, those objectives seem to be, to me, to be about reverse sensitivity, protecting mining from reverse sensitivity. Is that fair, or is that something that you, Mr. Levin, should comment on?
I think that is probably a fair comment, that the crux of those objectives there are about reverse sensitivity issues. Yeah.
And the last point is that you referred to the weight within your proposed RPS. Can you tell us what provisions are, what does the proposed RPS actually say about mining? Anything or nothing?
That's a good question, Commissioner Robinson. I actually haven't cited any provisions from the proposed RPS, and I don't have it in front of me to quote from, but I can follow up with the relevant parts.
Appreciate that. I think you've probably looked up where my friend and colleague, Commissioner Sinclair, might be disputing for that. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
In that case,
thank you, Mr. Levy. Where's his evidence?
Thank you. Firstly, I know that my evidence is clear on behalf of New Zealand Council Mining and Carbo Limited. Mr. Todd is speaking, giving legal submissions on Carbo Limited tomorrow morning, I think.
We've just been told by email that he may not be.
Oh.
That's a difference for you.
I can't attend the hearing tomorrow, so I wasn't intending to come tomorrow. So, I've had a look through the redrafted objectives and policies. I thought it might be useful just to go through those quickly and say where my evidence is effectively consistent with what redrafted policies, objectives and policies. I'll hand out, I've got a summary of evidence here which has a table which goes through all that and might be easier.
Yes.
So there are a number of objectives and policies in the working draft that I can simply agree with, and they are outlined on that table. There's still a number that I prefer the wording of my
I think if you just give us a few moments, we'll read through it. It's probably the best. See here that you've got 3.2.4.8.1 submissions withdrawn. Is that
yes,
from your point of view, or is that wrong?
No, I understand that that's submission point 5.19.14 was to be withdrawn today.
Yeah, that's correct. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Ruby, could you help me out here? Because I'm trying to understand how you're appearing for with one set of evidence for someone that's basically one party wants certain changes and the other seem to want exactly the other?
Yes. I thought I'd explain that in my evidence. Carbo Limited are opposed to mining in the Glenrocky area. Carbo and New Zealand Tungsten were both clients of ours. I explained to them that it was difficult for me to do evidence on both sides of the fence. Both clients accepted that I would do my evidence and put my professional opinion forward, and they would accept that professional opinion. So I'm not an advocate for either party. Evidence is independent. You'll hear from tomorrow, maybe. Carbo aren't, although the Carbo further submission was a general submission, we oppose that submission in its entirety. The reality is that Carbo aren't opposed to all mining in the district. There's one particular area that Carbo don't want to see mining in.
But you're not speaking for Carbo today, are you? You're here as an expert.
Yes.
So, is there something particular in the Environment Court's Code of Conduct, Code of Practice, that 2014, that relates, provides any guidance or anything around this situation?
I deal with that in section 2.5 of my evidence, where I say the Environment Court's Code of Practice has an overriding duty to impartially assess the court. And in this case, my area of expertise of resource management can not advocate for the party engagement in the case, and for that reason, I was comfortable in preparing the evidence on both of my client's submissions.
Is there anything in the New Zealand Planning Institute's Code of Ethics?
Not that affects this.
Okay. Getting into the substance of it, the page 6.414, just in terms of the tungsten mining's what they're seeking there, will not cause permanent degradation. From a planning perspective, what do you understand by permanent?
Well, in terms of mining, permanent degradation could be a very big hole in the ground. And in terms of 4.18, my recommendation is not to adopt that new policy that New Zealand Tungsten Mining were seeking. My recommendation is to amend policy, I think it's number 3.2.5.1 now, so in an alternative way.
The first question, I suppose, then, in terms of the way you've written in 4.18 there, that's different to what's in the submission that Tungsten Mining said.
Yes,
no. So, the question is it within scope?
I believe so, yes.
Since that's a legal question, Ms. Hill, you might as well have a go.
Yes, I believe it is in scope as well, as we've talked at length yesterday with Ms. Baker Galloway and yourselves about the idea of collective scope. I believe that the relief sought by New Zealand Trucks and Mining in its original and further submissions and those provided in the evidence of Mr. Vivian, along with all the other, you know, relief and submissions seeking that relief and evidence being presented in support of those submissions, provides certainly a very wide range of collective scope for you to make those decisions within.
Thank you.
You couldn't perhaps identify which other submissions save us the trouble of trawling through them looking for potential candidates.
I could certainly undertake that exercise for you, but I don't know them off the top of my head.
So if you were going to do that, could I ask that you do it for the other ones that are in here where a different form of relief has been sought to what's in the submission, whatever, to find out whether there's scope for all of them?
Yes, that
Thank
would
you.
Be done.
Mr. Vivian, just going back to 417, in terms of the last two sentences there, you say, I do not agree with the words provide for in the policy as that is directive, they're not in accordance with the enabling intent of the RMA. So I just thought, well, by analogy, if the policy in the NZCPS is directive, then that would have been in terms of the enabling intent of the RMA, yet it appears to be in there. How would that be contrary to the enabling of the RMA?
So, the policy in the NZCPS, did you say?
The one
that King Sam was talking about. Related to.
Mm.
Well, in terms of policies, my understanding is that policies should be enabling, not directive. They shouldn't provide for an activity, as like the previous questions you had of Federated Farmers. You know, is it appropriate for the district team to provide for farming over other things in the rural area? In my opinion, enabling is certainly more consistent with the intent of the RMA.
So we should only be providing within the plan policies that provide for the enablement of...
For it to be an effect-based plan, ideally that would be the situation. Yes, I accept that there will be some instances where provide or recognise or whatever will be in policies, but... this particular policy, I believe, enables is more consistent with the intent of the Act.
So, taking that wider, is it just this particular policy, or there are other ones where...
No, there are other ones.
And sorry, when there are other ones, are there other ones that we should be changing to rewriting them so that they're enabling rather than...
Yes, certainly, yes.
Can you think of any instances where we might want to put policies in that are might have some form of limits or reduction, minimise? Using
yes,
words such as that?
Certainly the word minimise is quite often used in policies. For me, personally, I don't like the word minimising policies. I prefer to have it to be more effects-based. And certainly, whenever I do policy analysis, I try and make it effects-based.
Turning to 427... in terms of your recommendation for the objective. It's 3214, which... Oh, sorry, before I go there, just going back to 32131. I just wanted to check in terms of the... Make sure at least I'm on the same page. Which, under the new numbering, is that still the same?
3.2. No, I believe it's 3.2151.
Yeah. Right. And then, where Tungsten Mining seeks that new policy up in 4.163, the new objective 3.2.1.3.
Yes.
Are you accepting? Sorry, what's your view on that new objective? Since the piece below is really only regarding the policy. Do you have a view on that objective?
The objective
3.2.1.3 in 4.1.6, if you will.
Haven't looked at it in enhance and sustain key local service and employment functions. I haven't looked at that.
I've asked anyone who can hear when I was asking some of the other planners today. What is it? What's an objective and what's a policy from a planning perspective?
An objective is where you want to go or where you want to be in the future. And a policy is the means to get there.
So, you may have changed this in terms of the ones that you agree with here, but I'm sorry, I'm just going through your evidence. In 4.2.7, that objective there, given that it's a direction of the goal you're trying to achieve, where you wish to go, does that meet that?
Yes, in terms of the working draft, I've agreed that the wording of the working draft is appropriate, although I do qualify that. I do believe that the word some, potential for some rural areas, needs to be in that policy, in the objective, sorry.
At the risk of being a 441 and 444 of your evidence, so at the risk of being a pedant, is it 6A or 6B? Or is it both?
Sorry, that should be.
Yeah. 4.6.5 on page 14.
Yes.
So I was trying to saying that I consider the words to locate necessary to give meaning to the policy, and also consider the word existing before urban areas is unnecessary. Just could you clarify why is that unnecessary in terms of that one? pardon, it's been withdrawn, sorry. It all relates to the part that's been withdrawn, so we can skip that part. In 481, it's a, just to clarify, it's actually about the policy rather than the objective.
Yes, sorry. Yep.
In 414.5, you're referring to the objective, which was 3271. So you've, and based on your latest part here, you've agreed with the changes.
Yes.
For that, okay. In 519 on page 25. Just in terms of the amendments of the policy, is it appropriate within a policy to actually say that the policy is that it will be assessed against the assessment matters in the provisions?
We have policies in the Auckland District Plan Act, and they were imposed by the Environment Board, so
Not that I'm going to say that the Environment Court got it wrong, but in terms of planning practice, is it usual to identify, to do the assessment criteria first and then relocate them, refer back to them within the policy? Or is it the other way around?
Usually it's the other way around. You would look at the district-wide objectives and policies first, and then when you get into the actual zone, which in this case would be the rural area, then you usually have a policy in there that refers back to the original policy. I haven't come across a policy I can think of that refers back to assessment criteria, because usually the assessment criteria is there to guide consideration of the policies.
Turning to pages 27 through 29, in fact, the recommendation in regard to refers to it says it's a policy, but this is in 5.3.14. Follow that recommendation when it starts off talking about objective 632. I couldn't follow how we get into a change in the is it in fact the objective in 632 that you're referring to on page 27? So that's, sorry, did you say that was correct, Mr. Brady?
I'm just checking that. Yeah, it appears the on the working draft, the objective that has been crossed out is 632, which is the objective that I included there. And to that extent, I've agreed with the change in the working draft. So it's gone from avoid and rescue with effects. I recommend a remedy which had been inserted going to landscapes are protected from the effects of the use and development.
So you're agreeing with the changes now made in the vehicle draft?
Yes.
That's me, thank you. Commissioner Cox, do you have any questions, Mr. Brady?
No.
Thank you. On your page 13, recommendation for 45.6, you acknowledge you're adjusting to house trust. I'm just wondering why you are suggesting that we downplay the level of seeking from sought to considered.
Well, yeah, I think that the point I wanted to make is not all public access is A, desirable, and C, necessary. And there needs to be a process where you consider the public access that is on offer. And that's how I'll try to change that policy.
But is Travellers Trust necessarily only arbiter of the decision, because there would be also particularly fish, particularly mountain bike, people just want to walk maybe away from trails, trust trails, and,
yeah,
and have a bit of peace and quiet. So I can understand you having that thought perhaps your Travellers Trust had not been interested in an expert is actually what the plan wants. Because
considered is obviously a much lower threshold than seeking, and others might consider that it's a worthwhile thing to pursue. Mm-hmm.
I think they
essentially
achieve the same thing.
They're still considering options for public access at the time of hand chance. There are instances where public access has been turned down through a residence consent application, for example, because of ongoing maintenance, and is responsible for that. But certainly, the desirability and the ability to consider it is important. The desirability and the ability to consider the public access is how the important.
Just while we're on that section, I just wondered in the next paragraph, you considered section 6D or 7C. Have you given any consideration to section 229?
7 terms of Esplanade.
Yes, which does give a priority for.
Yes, I hadn't thought of it in terms of Esplanade reserves. It seems to be more of an automatic thing in most cases.
On page 21, your 4.12.6, just wondering how encouraging you believe that subdivision use development would help meet other other strategic directions such as replacing conflict driven form, other kinds of work, precision structure, networks, etc.
That's another one where I've agreed with the working draft comments, changes there.
Sorry, so that is?
That is 5.3.2.5.3.
Did you 5.3?
Yes. New urban subdivision use and development will occur in those areas that which have potential to absorb change without detracting from landscape and visual use of areas.
Okay, so
any
questions? Thank you. And on your page 30, bottom of the page, 5.4.5, did you actually mean to take that same natural landscapes out of it? Because it
yes, I did.
Because you actually referred to that as far as I could see the merit.
Well, I say in 5.4.4, I consider the proposed version can be approved by deleting unnecessary text and information effects based. To me, there's no need to have those words in our standard natural landscapes and raw lake landscapes because if you're adjacent to it, ONF, then are adjacent to it. The majority of the cases you're going to be in another landscape category.
Okay. And what if you're in the land use in a residential zone or a large lot zone? So there are instances where OEFs do join those zones. Your suggestion widens up to include those.
Hmm. I see what you mean.
That wasn't intended.
No. I'm just trying to think of in terms of how because you wouldn't be in that instance if where an urban boundary is right up to an ONF, like say Peninsula Hill for example.
Queenstown Hill.
The urban zoning is excluded from the landscape classification in any case. So by having those words in in the outstanding natural landscapes and rural landscapes, it is better. Yes, I agree with that.
It depends on how we evaluate Section 6.4.1.
Mm.
Suggests that those policies may apply in other zones, doesn't it?
Possibly, yes. But yeah, certainly in terms of that recommendation, I would.
Rule 3.3 suggesting some new definitions. Are there any underground gas storage facilities in Queenstown Lakes District?
Not that I know of.
And if there aren't, do you think we need to provide them?
Just thinking, a lot of houses use geothermal gas to warm houses.
Does that really help you do?
Not LPG, no. I'm not too sure, but I know that there are. It's a very expensive system that people put in where they can drill down and heat their houses.
The ground source heat. Yeah.
Ground source, yeah. I'm not sure if that would fall into that or not.
I think they might be. You're not going to be getting hot air out of it.
Can I just clarify your understanding? Is that in terms of an underground gas storage facility, is that basically a tank, like you might have in service?
I haven't given that much thought at all, sorry.
I know there is a resource concern, but has it been implemented in Wanaka for an underground gas storage facility to serve quite LPG storage through one suburb?
Right, and there's several over this side as well. For example, Franklin Marine has an underground petrol storage facility. That's in the rule.
Certainly, I know there is at least one in Taranaki.
Yeah.
In the context of mining, that's what it's aimed at rather than an underground.
Yeah, I'm from Taranaki, so I agree that.
Somewhat different sort of,
yeah. My other question, Vivian, related to your 5.7.8 and your suggestion in relation to policy 6.3.4, where you shifted policy effectively expressing that the expectation that there will be no large scale large-scale renewable electricity generation with new large-scale mineral extraction development proposals are not likely to be compatible with O&Ls, and you turn it around to acknowledge the need to balance protection of those values, so you're certainly admitting the possibility that they might occur, a greater possibility. What took my eye was your Section 32 analysis suggesting the costs of incorporating that policy are nil.
Mm-hmm.
And I invite you to explain to me how that could be.
I see what you mean. You said the costs should include, it could be cost to the landscape. Apologise for
that. And if we're talking a new large hydro or a new open cast mine, those costs might presumably be quite large.
Correct. If we are talking of development at that scale.
Thank you.
Submissions for castles, etc., which we have. It might be more expedient if we give them the opportunity to just read through those first and then ask any questions.
Yes, sure.
That might save us a little bit of time.
Of course.
Thank you.
them. The first is in relation to your paragraph 3.2, saying to achieve the full potential of Chapter 3 should ensure that it adequately addresses all of the district's resource management and planning issues. The question is, and this is really a planning issue, if we fill Chapter 3 up with an adequate response to every issue raised to the district, is there anything left for the balance in the plan? And will we have lost the strategic focus of Chapter 3?
That's a valid question, Commissioner Robinson. Thank you. And to answer it directly, if you take that sentence on its face value, yes, perhaps Chapter 3 would end up being quite large. So perhaps I'll clarify that the intent of that paragraph 3.2 is to really state that we think that Chapter 3, being the strategic direction chapter of the plan, which sets that higher order guidance, I guess, in future decision making, should really provide a balanced approach to the resource management planning issues at hand for the district, and it should recognise and provide for, as far as possible, a balance of what are the core issues. And I guess the flavour of these submissions is, and I heard a little bit of it presented to you this morning as well, is that perhaps Chapter 3 currently seems weighted in favour of protection of the natural environment, as opposed to recognising the need to protect and provide for the built environment as well to achieve quality outcomes.
Thank you for that. And the last point is your suggestion, 3.9, suggested new policy, identify special character heritage areas and ensure they're protected from inappropriate development. For the record, what's your test of appropriateness?
Well, we could probably helpfully draw on the Supreme Court's consideration of what appropriate means and or what inappropriate means, and that that definition is coloured by what is sought to be protected.
Can I remind you that I seem to recall you suggesting on behalf of another client that the guidance from the Supreme Court was limited to the case-specific situation of the NZCPS. Do you have a consistency problem there? Or is my recollection imperfect?
The main crux of those further submissions on behalf of Ayrburn and Mount Coodorin Station and others was to exemplify that in the context of those submissions, what was relevant to take from the Supreme Court's decision in King Salmon was that one could come up with a planning instrument which provided for a higher threshold test than Part 2 wording, but that didn't necessarily have to be the case, and to arrive at that outcome had to be adequately justified by the facts in a Section 32 analysis. That was the main crux of those submissions.
Thank you, Bill.
So, related to that paragraph, the identify special character and heritage areas, is there any definition, or what's a special character area?
Thank you, Commissioner St. Clair. There is no proposed definition for special character or heritage areas, but I note that in the chapter on heritage and also in other areas, there are similarly non-defined terms as well. And I think that that could be appropriately something which is not subject to a definition, and that it should be coloured by subjective interpretation of particular values of the community.
In this case here, though, it's the special characteristics of the special character would relate to the gardens rather than, I don't know, the special character of the waterfront at a particular time of night.
Yeah, I think that would depend on the application at hand and the context in which, say, a development application might be relying on those higher order provisions within Chapter 3. It's not intended to be specifically talking about one specific special character or heritage area. Those might be different in different contexts.
Thank you.
Yes, in your 2.1b, it says it's the rock plays an important role for the basic property gardens, and close proximity to the city is very popular with visitors. I know park keepers until 2 nights ago when the sign went up, very popular with some transient visitors who are camping there, but what other things do visitors do in those blocks that makes it popular?
Well, it provides an important entranceway to the CBD and the township. It's possibly one of the first places where visitors will come and park, and depending on where they're coming from, obviously, but a lot might be arriving from the airport and, say, parking on that side of the town or entering the town through that precinct or those couple of blocks. So I think it's an important gateway to the gardens as well.
In fact, they don't generally go down there, they do that, they either come down past the church or around the coronation. Okay. And then you suggest identify special character and heritage areas, and I'm just wondering, in your 4.5, you say those provisions which constrain an appropriate grant within the Aratangi GP could equally apply to the area made adjacent to the gardens. So I'm assuming that means that your clients would be happy if the same permissions were applied to the area they're suggesting. Is that correct?
The same or similar. Similar in that if they were to achieve the same sort of outcomes, yes, those would be supported.
And then it says, this area, adjacent to the gardens, which exhibits important historical and cultural attributes and provides an important CBD, which should be maintained and enhanced in the future. Just wondering, could you enumerate those historical and cultural attributes? Well, I'm just wondering how you identify, if we're going to say that there are these areas, how do you identify them?
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Gilmore. I can't identify those. I'm not a historical expert. But it is the intent of my clients to bring that evidence at later hearings.
Okay.
And the intent of these submissions is just to focus on...
Thank you, that's what I needed to know.
Okay, thanks.
Just on that same period, what are the provisions you're talking about that constrain the inappropriate development of caravan use?
So I'm talking within Chapter 4 about the specific UGB objectives which relate to Arrowtown.
Yeah, understood. Thanks.
And in particular, just at 4251, the second bullet point, the character and identity of the settlement, and its setting within the landscape is preserved for enhanced. So I'm talking about the flavour of those.
Thank you.
proposed to read my submissions, given that you can't admit it, but perhaps if I just take you through them. I do need a few comments as we go through. So Peninsula Bay Joint Venture owns land in Wanaka. The land is currently owned, zoned open space, and we've got whatever proposed plans. Peninsula Bay has lodged a plan of land change to extend the existing low-density residential zone approximately 150 metres northwards and to discrete clusters. And I've got a little plan there from the plan change itself that shows where the areas are to be designed.
Just the two orange bits?
Just here. So here So that land is currently zoned open space, but it is immediately adjoining land zoned low density residential. So the private plan change seeks the creation of 26 low density lots, and they're quite large, they start at 1,030 m and range up to 5,300 square metres in size. So in terms of status, the plan change has been notified to the submissions, and I believe that they close around about the 4th of April.
I think I saw the notice.
Yeah. Sorry, just to clarify, that's all going to go on a separate process and it's not...
Correct, that's right.
Through
the processes are running in parallel at this stage.
Thank you.
So Peninsula Bay's submission on the proposed plan addresses several chapters and also MAC 19. Essentially, these legal submissions today on the chapters before you relate to the terminology used in the plan, the relationship between objective policies and rules and Section 32, and I think those issues have all been covered not just by me but by several other lawyers, so I don't propose to address you in detail on those today. Just in terminology, I was preparation for today, I was reviewing the plan again, refreshing myself. I noticed that section 1.6.5 of the plan, which addresses the definitions, provides definitions are provided within this plan has specific meanings. Generally, plain English interpretation of words are encouraged, but there are definitions included within the Act and other legislation, such as the Building Act. And I think that is important, and I specifically referenced it here, but several of the other lawyers have, that there is so much case law now under the AMA that when you depart from that language, you can potentially end up in trouble. So I've addressed that as we go through in terms of the relevant provisions where I think that may be an issue. In terms of Section 32, I understand that there was an issue raised in terms of to whom does the Section 32 duty apply, as the Council has been subject to some criticism from some others, I think, on its Section 32 assessment. To whom the duty applies is left open in Section 32, but it is stipulated in Section 74 that is the territorial authority that has that duty. Now, in terms of that...
Before you roll on...
Yeah.
Can I just test that? Because clearly the duty when notifying a plan is on the council.
Okay.
And the issue that we discussed maybe most recently this morning is that if this panel chooses to accept any of the submissions seeking changes to the notified plan, it has to prepare its own evaluation. And the practical question to you is that if submitters are not going to give us the ammunition to compile that further analysis in the Section 32 assessment, how's the panel going to be in a position to do so and effectively come to
It is a common problem. I'm aware of other situations, and I think it happened in Christchurch where the panel required the council to go away and do another Section 32 assessment to support its decision.
My understanding is that in some cases they've had not just the council but other parties assist in that matter as well.
Yes, that's correct in some situations. That's a big job.
I think what Commissioner Robinson's suggestion is that if there are any 32AA changes that are set out, then that's probably likely to assist us.
Yes, I think that's fine, yeah. Then in terms of nature conservation values on page 5, panel helpfully pointed out that I have made a typo there, so objective 3.2.4.2, I had made a significant nature conservation value, so the word significant is missing. And that doesn't materially affect my submissions on that issue. The only place where I would want to change my submissions is in respect to paragraph 23b. So I accept that with the qualifier of significance, that the definition wouldn't apply to the vernacular area. But in my submission, the policy 3.2.4.2.1, which is clearly intended to address significant natural areas on the district land maps, which is fine, and I don't have an issue with that. But if the policy then is intended to implement the objective, then in my view, the objective still requires amendment. In terms of page 7, objective 3.2.5.1 and associated policy 3.2.5.1.1. My client's concern that he's been addressed by the council's redrafted objective. So the council officer, as I understand it, has proposed to amend the objective to include reference to inappropriate development.
I'm wondering what conservation or people's concern is with the definition of the location of outstanding natural landscapes and outstanding natural features when A, the open space zone is not included as part of this plan, and B, section 6, particularly 641, seems to say that those classifications only apply in the rural zone. And my understanding from the map that you provided, there's no rural zone adjoining the land that they're concerned with. It may be further down the hill, down the terrace. I have to warn you, I come to one of them, I bike to them there frequently, not on the open space, but on the level.
Chair, would we need that back by a certain time?
Sorry?
Would we need Ms. Thomas to come back by a certain time?
Oh, she's going to come back to us. We need to do it probably by the end of tomorrow.
That's fine.
You're in the shape of subject. Can I pose a question for you regarding your submissions at paragraphs 24 to 28? Proposition I put to you is that if is there the habitats of rarefied and vulnerable species be a subset of significant habitats of indigenous flora and fauna. So this amendment you're seeking might actually broaden the restrictive nature of this objective policy. Is that what you intend?
If the objective was amended, it would be amended to refer only to significant indigenous vegetation and significant habitats of indigenous flora.
My point is that that would have a broader effect than what there is at the moment, and a broader and therefore more restrictive effect. And therefore, then the question is that what you intend to achieve? In that case, you might care to reflect on that one too.
Just while we're in the same ballpark of paragraph numbers, just in terms of 32, it says, in its current form, the objective policies breaches section 75.3c of the RPS. Do you know how it lines up with the proposed RPS?
I did look at that and I couldn't see there wasn't any direct guidance, which I thought was directly relevant. I checked both.
I think there's been general unanimity about the among planners that it's very difficult to be inconsistent or not give effect to the operative Otago regional policy statement. Are you suggesting otherwise?
Well, in my view, I mean, having read the section 22 of this kind of evidence, there was no reason or no justification given as to why the word inappropriate was missing. And I now see that the council proposes to put it back in, so I'm not sure what's changed. I reread the Queenstown landscape decisions last night and noted that in terms of policy 6.3.1.3, the court held in the first landscape decision that just because an area is or contains an outstanding natural landscape does not mean that development is automatically inappropriate, which I thought was relevant to the hearing today. But also in that case, the court defined, in terms of the Waikato Basin, that in that case the court that development in that particular area may be generally inappropriate. Peninsula Bay is there because there's another Waikato Basin. So. Anything else?
protection of Ms Taylor. We have already discussed some of the pavilions. We have yet to redo that. I'll let Commissioner St Clair start the review.
While Commissioner St Clair is preparing, I do have one matter that might help just in terms of clarification, which relates to my previous appearance, if that's all right with you. Just in terms of Rule 6.4.1 point and that series of rules, and the question about whether the landscape provisions apply to non-rural zones.
Yes.
Upon rereading that, it seems the rules say the classification doesn't apply outside of the rural zone. So, say for example, in Niche Bay's case, or in Millbrook zone extension, they wouldn't be zoned. They're not zoned rural, so the classification doesn't apply. But Rule 6.4.1.2 says the objectives and policies are relevant where lands in all zones where landscape values are at issue. So it does leave us in a slightly difficult position because the rule is draft that says the classification doesn't apply but the objectives and policies do. So that's quite tricky in my view because a lot of the objectives and policies of course refer to the classifications to assist guidance about what's relevant.
Just while we're up, what's your view in terms of the title rules? Do they meet what you think are the criteria of what a rule might be?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, they're not traditional rules in the sense that they have to be complied with, and if they're not, certain activity status applies. So, to me, they're more guidance rights or directions, or may even be better in a policy.
Guidance notes or policies, could they be categorised as an explanation of how the plan is supposed to work?
Yes. Although I would be, to have something so, they're quite significant, you know, whether something's considered as an ONL or not is quite important. So to have something as an explanation is, you know, I imagine the lawyers would have a field day with that. Where you're arguing what applies and what doesn't.
And we've had some previous discussion on this.
Oh,
okay. Commissioner Robinson reminded, I can't remember who it was, reminded someone of the Tawaka case in Hawke's Bay where land outside an identified ONL was held to be an ONL and raised with that instance. Doesn't disappear when the coastal lines are drawn on the maps in this district.
Well, I think, you know, it could be assessed, an application needs to be assessed in the context of its site. And in that, in every instance, you would, if it has landscape values, you would need to assess it in terms of those values on that site. And
so even if the objectives and policies didn't explicitly deal with an ONL in the land, for instance, that's zoned open space adjoining Lynchburg Bay, if the evidence was that it was using small cap, small letters, an outstanding natural landscape,
yes,
then Section 6B would be operative in any event, wouldn't it?
Yes. It doesn't seem to me to be all that helpful, though. Decision makers to have this sort of slightly messy situation, what I see is a messy situation about, you know, whether the ONL applies here or it doesn't. I mean, my understanding is that there's been significant litigation in this district, certainly about where the ONL lines should go and where they shouldn't, and seems that it may be that it seems unusual to me to say that they don't, that ONL classification wouldn't apply when the Environment Court's already found that it should apply, and if they've already tested that.
And wasn't I might be wrong, but wasn't that line of the open space zone determined on the ONL ONL line at the time?
No, it wasn't. The ONL line is a different line to the open space line.
So the line's more from a, it's not a landscape ONL line, it's a planning practice method line, and this is where it is.
Sorry, in terms of Peninsula Bay?
Whichever the example you were just talking about.
Yeah, so in terms of Peninsula Bay, when the Peninsula Bay zone was went through the planning process, there was an ONL line which was drawn in the middle, essentially in the middle, and if you look at my evidence actually on page 17 of my evidence, you'll see that we've got the ONI, the orange line is the ONL line, and you'll see the if you imagine the two orange blobs gone, then that's what the plan shows at the moment in terms of open space, so that's all open space green zone, so that it's a different. And it's basically dealt with in terms of topography.
I think that most of the stuff we'd already covered off earlier today. Just one though, and in 4.4 of your evidence, just in regard to the outstanding landscapes and the indigenous flora and fauna, is this to do with the bit that the chair raised with Ms. Thomas just around that, the interest in these significant flora and fauna? So does that still remain?
Certainly there is an interest in this. So in terms of Peninsula Bay, there are areas of vegetation of ecological value, but not identified as, I've forgotten the terminologies, it's not a significant natural area as determined in the plan, as identified in the plan.
Thank you.
Just a series of related questions about your table. Ms. Taylor, so we start with objective 4.2.1, page 9 of your table. Right table, right one. Occupational hazard.
Page?
Page 9.
To the evidence?
The evidence. Yep. And you make the same, essentially the same argument in relation to objective 4.2.6 on page 10. And so the issue is that protect is not commensurate with the landscape being considered. On the basis that the landscape being considered in 4.2.1 includes outstanding natural landscapes, would you reconsider that? Is there a need to divide up the ONLs from the others? On the basis of section 6B would suggest that the value of the landscape is commensurate with protection.
From an appropriate use and development, yes. Well, certainly my evidence on the similar provisions in the landscape chapter was that it would be more helpful, I think, to separate out how we deal with ONL and ONF landscapes than others. So certainly I think you could apply that logic in terms of chapter 4. Well,
and policy 6.3, 1.7, again, we were talking about urban effects on ONLs and ONFs. Does a void gravity or mitigate any cover? Is that recognising and providing for those landscapes and features? Or that, and the protection of those landscapes and features?
So it's a new 6.3, but 1.6,
that's right, isn't it? Well, I was going off
your... Yes, no, you're correct. I was just double-checking in the section 32 that way. I am comfortable with the wording that I had there. Certainly in an ONL, ONF landscape, it's appropriate in my view to look at particularly mitigation and not simply avoiding effects or activities.
How does urban development mitigate effects on ONL?
Well, it depends.
In a substantive way, not planting a hedge.
Yeah, well, in the Peninsula Bay example, there are parts of the zone extension request that does go into the ONL, and that was done in a very careful way because of the obvious concern that it's an ONL and we must ensure that we're keeping that landscape from an appropriate use of development. And the work that's been done and looked at landscape effects, visual effects of that development, ecological effects, and what can be enhanced from an ecological point of view. And certainly the Section 32 report and the plan change request concludes that that has been, the Section 6 has been achieved there.
And once, if the plan change was granted and the development occurred, would it remain ONL?
Yes.
With urban development on it?
Well, when you say urban development, it's about if there's three or four parts of lots that are within ONL. So it's not simply a matter of saying we'll put a high density development in the middle of an ONL. The proposal in this case is to put some residential building platform within the ONL, but the majority of the area within the ONL is protected and enhanced ecologically. At the moment it's pretty low level ecological values, and there's an opportunity to enhance those through the plan change or through the rezoning.
So
just one, and that is on, I don't have the pages on this, but on objective 3243, and this has been come to an extent, but you suggested taking out the rare endangered as well as the species and giving us plant or and community. And I'm just wondering where that fits with the section 31 requirement of the Territorial Society to maintain indigenous biological diversity. So it's not just SMAs that we charge to protect.
Mm. Yeah, it possibly had a point there. I haven't gone through and looked at the relevant chapter. There are the balance provisions in the plan on that matter. So from a strategic direction point of view, my thinking was that it was appropriate to keep it at a more of a part two level, be clear about what we need to protect from a part two level, and then further down through the plan, there's other matters to take into account. So, but
it's not necessary to take it out over.
It may be appropriate, but it would just be important to be clear about what it is you're referring to and whether you're requiring protection or enhancement or what it is
you're doing. Okay, thank you. Is there anything in the RPS or proposed RPS that might provide assistance in regard to that? Or not?
I don't know off the top of my head. Probably not the operative one, but.
Not that I can think
of one of the close, but I've got it from.
Thank you. Thank you.
We get another chance tomorrow. Yes, you do. Ask you more questions. You think of anything there tonight? So.
I was going to ask you if it would be helpful for me to pull my tables together into one for you tomorrow, dealing with the recommendation. But then I wondered if it would just be confusing further because obviously you've dealt with some and not others. So in your hands, I'm happy to do that, but I don't want to add to your...
Well, you could do that, and you could just simply highlight the ones that we haven't dealt with.
Okay.
So I don't think there's really any left.
I think we're pretty much there, but at least I would have it in one package for you, and I can deal with the latest iterations in there.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Thank you.
So perhaps if I can talk to Mr. Taylor overnight around the objective 3.2.4.2 issue around significant nature conservation values and the issue that Mr. Robinson raised.
Yes.
I won't be here tomorrow, but my family will be.
Yes. Maybe a matter that Mr. Gardner Hopkins has to deal with anyway, knowing the site that he's dealing with.
Yes, I'm here for Paige this afternoon. I believe the panel does have a copy of my submissions.
Yes.
And I mean, the panel's hands. My preference is to stand if that is acceptable.
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you. And look, I'm not sure. I think they were only circulated this morning, so I'm not sure if the panel has had any opportunity. But I don't intend, unless the panel wishes, to read through verbatim. But I will follow the structure and really just walk you through the key points I wish to make for KJEP. And just at the outset, I do just wish to acknowledge Mr. Sean Kelly, who is sitting at the back with me. He's one of the directors of KJEP and one of the original founders of the company. So what I've tried to do is capture right at the start the key outcomes that KJEP is seeking on the panel in respect of this part of the process. In broad terms, a strategic planning framework that supports sustainable use and development, including, and in my submission, specifically in respect of the surface of the district's lakes and rivers. We say this framework is most appropriate in RMA terms, and we go further and we say that having that explicit policy support is necessary for
for companies like CAGED to have the confidence to invest and to go through the relevant consenting processes.
Just on that point, the witness who will be appearing tomorrow for Real Journeys has suggested that, in fact, the water spaces be given their own zone. Does CAGED have a position on that?
Look, I don't have final instructions on that. I think, to a large extent, that's a matter of form over substance. If the issues are sufficiently addressed within the current framework, then that would satisfy CAGED. If a separate chapter were to be separated out, I'm sure that, again, with the right wording, that would also be acceptable. I do know that that sort of issue was raised very recently in the context of the unitary plan in respect of the utility provisions, which at the start of the process were scattered throughout multiple chapters, and at this point in the process they've now been separated out into their own chapter. So certainly as a drafting technique it may have some merit. So there is an existing objective, 3.2.13, which is supported by CAGED. And it's in part in reliance on that objective that CAGED seeks the introduction of an additional policy.
Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, can you just satisfy my curiosity? You refer at paragraph 4.2 to its proposed bridge offering.
Yes.
In 30 seconds or so, what's the nature of...
That's explained at 3.1b, but there is currently an application before the council that has been lodged. It is being processed, but is currently on hold. But really it is to enable jet boat trips to travel, it says there, from the Arrow confluence down to the Karawau suspension bridge. And so to be able to drop the passengers off there to undertake a bungee jump activity, or for those who may have arrived to the bungee jump through other means, to be able to be picked up and returned via jet boat through to the town.
Thank you, Blake.
Also, just in terms of support for this additional policy, and this isn't addressed in my submission, but it is addressed in the evidence of Mr. Brown, who I believe the panel heard from last week, and it's addressed at paragraphs 4.9 to 4.12 of his evidence. But he supports the introduction of an additional objective, which I think Mr. Patz recommended, and that objective was to recognise and provide for significant socio-economic benefits of tourism activities across the district. I think there may have been some debate as to where that new objective would be inserted. Its location isn't of importance to CAGED, but it does support that objective, and that objective, if introduced, we say provides further support for the specific policy sought by CAGED.
Mr. Gavin, can I just clarify, this is in 4.1, this is a new objective?
So the objective that I have quoted at 4.1 is the existing objective.
Under the newest version, 3.2.1.4.
Right.
3.2.1.4. Thank you.
And I think there's some suggestion in terms of the drafting technique that the enabled component.
Yes,
it's 3.2.1.5.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah. So I think the current
proposal is to remove the word enable and have it as a more positive statement. And certainly that tweak to the drafting is acceptable to CAGE.
In relation to the specific policy you're suggesting that provide for a range of appropriate recreational activities, etc., I suppose my question is, what are the limits of the range? Or put another way, what's the test of appropriateness?
Yes. I had a feeling that question might be coming. Supreme Court has given some guidance on this. It focused more particularly on the term inappropriate, but it did actually make an observation at its paragraph 126 of its decision, where it talked about the use of the term appropriate in the policy relating to aquaculture in the NZCPS. So the policy relating to aquaculture said something along the lines of provide for aquaculture in appropriate locations. And the Supreme Court accepted that the term appropriate in that context had to mean suitable for aquaculture. And I would adopt the same approach and the same meaning to the use of appropriate here. It would have to be in locations suitable for the recreational activity.
And as I recall, the Supreme Court also said that that was suitable for aquaculture at a technical level, but subject to more directive policies.
Yes, yes. The Supreme Court acknowledged that the policy and its use of the word appropriate could not mean aquaculture could go anywhere where it was suitable for aquaculture.
And you would adopt the same position on my analogy?
Yes.
Take a rough with the smooth, as they say.
Yes. And that's why, and it's more of an issue, I think, for my other client tomorrow, there is a need to be very careful with the wording used in other policies. Because I think directive policies that do use similar language to policies 13 and 15, that do use avoid by reference to inappropriate activities, they have the potential, in effect, to take precedence over a policy that says simply enable in appropriate locations.
All dependent on what your objective is.
Yes, and the specific words. So my submission is that the use of inappropriate by itself in other policies still leaves some room for debate down the path as to what is inappropriate.
I take it from those submissions that in reading this policy, and it's objective, you actually have to take account of the other objectives and policies that may be applicable in the area. Is that
your suggestion? Yes. Including any that do focus on protection and preservation of the natural environment.
So would that therefore suggest that another place where this could perhaps be recognised would be in policy 6.3.8.2? And that it's a similar. We've got there that currently is recognised that commercial recreation and tourism related activities located within the rural zones may be appropriate for these activities, enhance the appreciation of landscapes on the basis that will protect, maintain, and enhance landscape quality character, which are really good.
What was that number?
6.3.8.2. And that I think is more of the different variants of the iterations of the. It's under a recognised dependence of tourism.
there. I do think there is a natural hierarchy, and Kate's preference is to have this policy included in Section 3 of the plan. But there could be other places that it can be addressed. I think if I can just perhaps return to briefly the King Salmon issue with policies 13 and 15, because the guidance given by the Supreme Court does need to be taken in the context of those policies and how they were structured. Because each of those policies starts off, and I think the technical term is with a chapeau, and it has an introductory sentence that identifies the objective of that policy as being to protect or preserve from inappropriate development. And then the policies go on to identify how the NZCPS intended to protect and preserve from inappropriate development. And it set up this very clear regime of avoiding adverse effects on ONLs, and then avoiding significant effects on other landscapes. And so it's not just the term inappropriate that was sort of the game changer. It was its combination with the term avoid and avoid significant. And the Supreme Court essentially said you have to look very carefully at the language used. Other policies use different language, and there has to be a meaningful difference attributed to that. So that's one reason I do say in this plan, which of course is a lower order document than the NZCPS or the RPS, you can still have policies, one that says enable appropriate recreational activities, and another policy that says, that has reference to inappropriate activities, depending on what is hitched to inappropriate. If it's avoid, well, that's a very strong signal. If it's avoid, remedy, or mitigate, well, that leaves some further room for interpretation.
Just picking up on your discussion of King Salmon. While I'm sure you're right, and that was the thrust of the Supreme Court's analysis, I think the majority also said, that their interpretation of inappropriate was the natural and ordinary meaning, probably listening to my discussion with Ms. Hill, that I think the in an earlier session, she referred me to the decision of Judge Hassan's court in Kaipara, which applied that on the basis that it was the ordinary and natural meaning more broadly. You got a view on that? I think it was Calverley in Kaipara.
Yes, I haven't read that recently. But my view is that inappropriate has to be assessed by reference to what is being protected, and that comes straight from the Supreme Court's decision. But at what point an activity has effects that tip it into the category of inappropriate can take meaning and colour from the wider policy framework as well as the factual circumstances.
I think a lot of that focusing clearly on what it is that what adverse effects are relevant, for instance, an outstanding landscape has to be protected from.
Yes.
And so that's where you would start. and then it's a ripple effect out from there.
That's right, and I think there does need to be a greater understanding of, well, what about any particular landscape, what are the values that make it outstanding, and how should those values be protected? And it may be that it's the ice-sculptured geological features that make a particular landscape outstanding. In a different context, it may be the type of vegetative cover. And what might be acceptable or appropriate could well differ depending on the type of outstanding landscape. Probably trespassing into some of the discussion for tomorrow for my other client, but I think in terms of relevance for KJET, it does come back to the importance of the language used and the importance of having policy direction in the plan. Because if the plan only has policy direction around preservation or if it has gaps in what it wishes to signal, it wishes to enable, then that could have significant consequences for the evaluation of a consent application in terms of the plan support. And that really is why KJET is here, you know, advocating strongly for the inclusion of this one policy. It sees it as significant for the determination of its current, if not future, applications. I think we've sort of talked around probably most of the key issues. I'm not sure I need to take you through the background to KJET. It is there, it has a long history of operating in the district, and it has a commitment and a wish to operate into the foreseeable future and to maintain and grow its business. At 3.1, at A and B, I just record really again by way of background, but why this is so important for KJET. It has two current applications for the council. First relates to reinstatement or replacement of consents that were found recently to have lapsed because the court found that they had not been exercised. And so there is the potential for a substantive debate on whether those consents should be granted. Without wanting to assume that there will be appeals, there could well be appeals on that, or it's what we're calling the Bungee Bridge application, which is a new application to run a different stretch of the river, and there are some complications with that too in terms of its interface with the council's current navigation bylaws. So there are some hurdles there, and a number of submissions from a range of other interests. And so the policy direction given, even in the proposed plan and even at an early stage, we say is an important part of the evaluation matrix. In terms of relief sought, I've recorded retention of that particular objective. And then in terms of the current structure, and the numbering may have changed, I think this particular objective just still has two policies sitting underneath it. And one policy focuses on enabling activities on commercially zoned land, and the other relates to climate change. And so we say, well, there's an obvious gap there in terms of enabling activities that aren't covered by those two policies. And we say, without filling that gap, there is a risk in a consent application that an opponent or a decision maker could simply say, well, actually, there isn't that support at the strategic level. And I do take the point, you can't fill in every single issue into this one chapter. We say this is important, and KGIP is strongly seeking its conclusion. Briefly, just on section 32 and the test of most appropriate. And I think even though I was dealing with the plan change, I don't think the Supreme Court actually gave too much guidance on the use of that phrase, most appropriate, in its decision. And I'm not sure it's the same observations about inappropriate and appropriate apply to quite the same extent to the term as used in section 32 when coupled with most appropriate. There is some legislative history. Once upon a time, section 32 requirement was that a provision needed to be necessary. And so the current version is most appropriate. And so I say that's intended to allow greater flexibility for a planning authority to choose from a range of options. And they don't have to demonstrate some threshold that something is necessary. But what I say it means is when a hearing panel such as yourself has a range of options before you, and in terms of this policy, you obviously have a decision not to adopt it, or to adopt it as sought, or with some variation of wording, the requirement is to consider, well, which of those options is most appropriate for achieving the relevant objectives.
Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, do you have a view on what General Hazard and Justice King meant in rational transport when he said that most appropriate meant or didn't mean most suitable?
Yes, I
or superior? Because I've already asked one counsel that, having it done it, that defeated me.
Yes, I have difficulty with that. I'm not closely familiar with the full circumstances. I certainly think most appropriate doesn't provide free license for a planning authority to go on its own inquiry and to identify what might be the best option. You know, it's also if presented with a blank piece of paper. But I can't see any other meaning when there are a certain number of alternatives available that most appropriate must require some sort of comparison between them and the choosing of something that is better. Now, I don't go so far as to say if there are three or four options and one might be the best. I think previous authorities have said that it doesn't necessarily go that far.
Is it not choosing the worst?
Yes. Well, I think there is a risk of failing to comply with the statute directive of adopting the most appropriate if the worst alternative was chosen.
Didn't choose the worst, you may have satisfied the test.
Potentially.
Mr. Young, if we were looking for this change in terms of the 32.A test that we need to do, can you remind me whether this was addressed to Mr. Brown's evidence? I think
yes.
I can't recall.
No, it wasn't. Submission would be that Mr. Brown, look, he only addresses it in perhaps four paragraphs. He does have a table that it captures some of the matters that would inform Section 32AA requirements. And so whilst he hasn't done a formal assessment, my submission would be that he has given the building blocks that would enable the panel to do so. And accept that doesn't make your job as easy perhaps as it should.
Thank you.